We met as soulmates on Paris Island. We left as inmates from an asylum. And we were sharp as knives. And we were so gung-ho to lay down our lives. We came in spastic, like tameless horses. We left in plastic, as numbered corpses. And we learned fast to travel. Playboy, they gave us Bible. We dug in deep and shot on sight and prayed to Jesus Christ with all of our might. We had no cameras to shoot the landscape. We passed the hash pipe and cleared our doorsteps. And it was dark, so dark at night. And we held on to each other like brother to brother. We promised our mothers we'd write.
Yeah. This is Dr. Steve Nurse, and this is our last episode of our third series on Vietnam. It's called A Letter as a Living Voice. And we originally started out with letters to and from Vietnam, but we kind of morphed into a more eclectic group of examples of what was going on in Vietnam at the time. And so hope you enjoy this series. I can't go on at this point without thanking my co-workers and other highly paid co-workers here. First of all, Rick, who is our engineer and has given me many, many sage comments through this whole series. And also Susan Schreyers, who has been invaluable and probably saving my eyesight by going through old newspaper articles and transcribing those. And also being very close, having relatives that served in Vietnam. And so I think that that's really what we really want to get across in this series. We're going to give you some of our personal reflections on this. But first of all, I really want to go to and look at some statistics and just to kind of understand what the total impact was of on United States in Vietnam. We're actually very close right now to the anniversary, well, April 30th, which was my birthday, and also which was the end of the war, the official end of the war, was April 30th, 1975. And so I think it's important to note that. Just let me go through a few statistics that I think really give you an impact. Even though we've got so much information from individuals and interviews and letters, and we're also going to go through some sound bites here. But first of all, there were 9,087,000 military personnel that served on active duty during the official era from August 5th, 1964 to May 7th, 1975, in the military. Now, that's not all the people in Vietnam, but it shows you the impact of the military. The Vietnam, there were 2,709,918 Americans who served in uniform in Vietnam. 58,148 were killed in Vietnam. And, you know, so many times now we talk in terabytes and megabytes and all those kinds of things. But when you think about that, close to 3 million people served in Vietnam. And you think of the size of cities, and it really does come home. Of those that were in Vietnam, 75,000 were severely disabled. 23,000 were 100% disabled. 5,283 lost limbs. I mean, that's, you think about that. I mean, that's got to affect jobs, certainly affects emotional well-being. 1,081 sustained multiple amputations. Of those killed, 60. Now, here, this shows something too. Of those killed, 61% were younger than 21 years old. 61% were younger than 21 years old. 11,465 of those killed were younger than 20. Of those killed, 17,539 were married. Now, think about that statistic. So 18,000 were married. You have one person that's killed in Vietnam, but how many more persons, how many more families, how many more aunts, uncles, fathers, mothers, brothers, sisters that affected? Average age of men killed was 23.1. And as of, and I think this is really important, as of April 14th, 2017, there are 1,611 Americans still unaccounted for from the Vietnam War. In Vietnam, there were about 1,200. In Laos, we were not supposed to go into these other countries. In Laos, there were 300 killed. Cambodia, 49. And China, 7. I think there were also some positives that we need to also mention. 87% of Americans hold 87% of Americans hold Vietnam veterans now in high esteem, which was not necessarily the case when they got out. 85% of Vietnam veterans made successful transitions to civilized life in the United States. And I also want to maybe comment on that statistic a little bit, because we call that a successful transition. There was no one that Rick or I or Susan have heard in the studio that did interviews. There was no one, and these are people that have, many of them have made successful transitions. There was no one that was not affected by that experience in Vietnam. 97% of Vietnam veterans were honorably discharged. And 91% of Vietnam veterans say are glad they served. So I think that those are some really, really important statistics to be aware of. One of the things that I wanted to do today was to get opinions from Rick and get opinions from Susan, and I'm going to chime in here also about our opinions of what struck us most in being involved in this series. And everyone is affected differently. So, Susan, why don't we start with you? What are some of the things about the voices you heard, the letters you read, that struck you most, or even your own experiences with a family? What are some of the things that struck you the most about this series and the issues that we've addressed about Vietnam?
Well, we talked about this a bit earlier, Steve. The perspective, you know, in the time of Vietnam, I was a young 18, 19, 20, 21-year-old. I looked at these young men who were going over there as men. Now, 50-some years later, I just, as a mom, I just see them as boys, and the culture shock. I think about this all the time, of going from your mom's house where she takes care of you and all of a sudden being in boot camp and then being in a foreign country where the culture, the weather, everything about it is different and foreign. And forget the fact that there's a war going on. Just that culture shock had to be traumatic for these guys. That really struck me. And also, you gave all these statistics, but I don't know the statistic, but I know that I've heard it. How many thousands of the Vietnam veterans came back between the 60s and now and have committed suicide?
Right.
I don't have that statistic in front of me, and I don't know if you do, but that's one of the things that really struck me, that there was something that was so broken in their transition to war and their transition back from war that didn't prepare them.
And, you know, we talked about, you know, you mentioned the fact that, you know, maybe at one morning, those boys, young men, whatever we want to say, got up and had breakfast with their, you know, with their mothers or fathers and got on a bus and probably served a little bit of time here in a, you know,
some kind of training.
Training. But also, and then once they got on a plane within 12 hours or 14 hours or wherever they stopped, they were, you mentioned a different culture and all these different things, but also they were such dramatically different. I mean, you know, the temperature. We had so
many of the letters mentioned that as soon as they landed and the doors opened on the plane, it felt like a steam bath.
Yes. Or I could taste the weather. You know, one guy says, I knew I was in Vietnam when pilot said, the minute we land, get off the plane and start to run, you know, get undercover, that they were being shelled. The weather, also the food, and we talked about expectations. I mean, if you take a trip to Disneyland, you know you're probably going to see Mickey Mouse. But when you went to Vietnam for the first time, to many people said they thought it might be an adventure, you know, to carry a gun and to, you know, kind of almost play the army that you did when you were a kid. But all of a sudden it's real, and the bullets are real, and you're in a different world. You know, we don't understand what a triple canopy is, where it's 12 o'clock in the afternoon, bright sunlight, and you can hardly see your hand in front of your face. Anything else, Susan, you can think of?
There were so many remembrances because... Yeah. So many years have passed, and Steve, to be honest with you, I wasn't thinking about Vietnam when you called me and asked, or when you posted and asked somebody to do some transcribing for you. I hadn't been thinking about it in many years, and all of a sudden, it's you know, it's right there in front of my eyes. I'm thinking about it a lot more. You know, I'm married to a Vietnam veteran, and this is one of the things that really struck me when we first got married. This is something I don't recommend to anybody. We got married a couple weeks after he got back from Vietnam, which is, you know, it's a tough start. But one of the benefits I've had is that he's a fanatic about fresh sheets, because in Vietnam, you know, he went from his mother's house, where the sheets were changed weekly, I'm guessing, to Vietnam, where he had no access to wash his sheets and no change of sheets for a year. In a tropical climate where, you know, you just sweat all night and sleep in the same sheets every day.
Yeah.
And so when he came back, he said, you know, I'll do it, but I really need to have fresh sheets every day. So for the first probably 6 months we were married, we had fresh sheets every day.
And isn't it interesting, the minute things that strike us? You know, one of the things that I have not become a fan of is fruitcake that you get at Christmas time with all the little green and red things in it. And when I was married, my wife had a can of this. They put it in cans, in this fruitcake. And we transferred that to probably three or four different places that we lived. And I think finally the can blew up. But there was one gentleman, veteran, that I remember saying that he had been separated from his platoon. He was trying to get back. He hadn't eaten in about 2 days, he said. And so he found a garbage truck that was heading back to where his platoon was. And so he asked him if he could have a ride. So he got a ride. And he's actually in the back of the garbage truck. And he finds a ration can of that had been unopened of fruitcake. And his comment to me was, that was the best food I've ever had in my life. Now, again, it's those tiny things, that just strike us. One guy who was a veteran. He was on the front line all the time, and they would remember small things like they might have a memento that when he was in an ambush, he saved an empty cartridge and made that into a necklace. Hmm. It's those kinds of things that I just find are really interesting. Rick, how about you?
Well, the what Susan was saying, how these kids, if I can call them that, were taken from what we consider to be a normal existence and just ripped out of it and placed into this obscenely surreal environment where not only their lives, but everybody around them, their lives were all at risk, and they had to learn to live with that, and for a whole year, and worse yet, maybe knowing that it was for 1 year, that it was going to be over. All you had to do was manage to survive that year, and you'd be out of there. And from what I've heard from, I did not serve in Vietnam. But from what I've heard of people saying that they couldn't tolerate the idea that it was, that they were going to get out. Everybody had to have the belief that they were going to be destroyed in this meat grinder. And it's the only way that they could maintain their sanity is to know that today doesn't matter because I'm going to die. And it was only when you got down to the last month or so that you could actually begin to realize that you might be able to make it out. And then you got really paranoid about every little snap and crackle and pop and taking that. And to try and imagine people living through that and then coming home, like you say, to board the airliner and 24 hours later you're home, to have that be your reality is just mind-boggling to me.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting. Go ahead, Susan.
Well, something else I think about is that in Vietnam, they could have one tour of duty over there. It was real unique circumstances if someone went back a second time. And now the young men who are in the military now sometimes serve 2, 3, 4. They keep sending them back. And I don't know the impact that we're going to feel from this generation of young men going forward.
You know, that's really important because, you know, we hear of people going back into Afghanistan that are, you know, from Fort Lewis that have gone back and done 3 or 4 different tours of duty. The thing that struck me also, and we talked about this, was that a lot of folks sent pictures. Gary Burka sent me pictures, and he was one of that received, what was the award that he received? Was it the Bronze Star? He was one of the first ones, but for, you know, saving other people's lives and under very dangerous situations. And yet when you see the pictures of these young men, they're all smiling, you know, they're all smiling. They kind of don't know what's around the bend. And once they got in, like you said, like Rick said, once they got into that meat grinder it was a different story. I think there was, you know, also one of the things that I've always said and is that you have to have humor in any situation. And I think humor and the ability to laugh, we actually know those things are good for the human body. And even in situations like that, there were some humorous things. I got some sound bites here that I pulled from some of the folks that we interviewed. Here's one. It says, I was a machine gunner. The M60, which is a pretty large machine gun. Usually you had one person also going with you just to feed the cartridges in it, or it might also have been used on a Huey as for ground cover. I carried that M60, and he says, after being wounded and healing up, I went back to the field and became an RTO, or a radio telephone operator. Then the last 2 months of my job in Vietnam, I was assigned a liquor inventory job. He said, my math was terrible. So I think that's pretty important. I also remember this one was very good. He said, they also had me doing KP. It was very hot in the kitchen, and I remember the cook stirring soup with a large paddle that looked very much like a small boat oar. He says, as I watched him, I realized he had a bead of sweat on his nose. It dropped. I chose not to eat that night. So I think it's interesting to hear those kinds of things and how they relate. Now, this came from, this one came from Robert Barrett, who has actually, since we started this series, has passed away. He was in his 90s, and he was shot down over Hanoi in a plane, and he served almost 7 years in the Hanoi Hilton. And he said that... After he got home, and Rick and I talked about this too. After I got home, my wife and I were having a home built, and they were looking around at plans, and she said that the master closet was too small. I looked and said it was bigger than my cell in the Hanoi Hilton. So those kinds of things. Other things that are very honest. I did not want to go, but that's what you did back then. The airport was being shelled as we landed. I thought, great start. You know, for good luck, I carried a pocket-sized New Testament Bible with a steel plate in the cover that my father gave to me. I'm going to admit that this one came from me, this soundbite. And this is very true. He said, when I took my draft physical in Seattle in 1968, I was thinking about getting married at that time. I had just done my student teaching experience, and I was ready to go teach the next year. And we took our draft physicals down on the waterfront in Seattle. They took us by bus from Ellensburg with a lot of my classmates. And you basically stripped to your shorts and you stood in a line for about 3 hours. And they had different doctors checking you out for vision and hearing and all kinds of things. This is kind of embarrassing, but my mom sent me with a note. She said to give it to whoever was the sergeant there. And it says, the note said, Steve's mom excuses him from military duty. So I didn't go in the Army, but I don't think it was my mom's note that got me out of the military service.
Sounds like it worked out well for you.
Well, it did, and I remember when I got my note that I was that I had a deferment because I was teaching special education.
What did the sergeant say when you handed him the note?
That's a good point. What he did said, I don't think anyone's going to get back to your mom about this. So, and even that experience was so kind of dehumanizing. I don't, you know, Rick, how you, if you kind of went through the same type of thing, but go ahead.
Well, I'm going to say one of the things that I remember is everybody getting their head shaved.
Oh, yeah.
They line you up. I think you still had our civilian clothes on. This is when we first get the basic training. And they hadn't got us uniforms yet, but they lined us all up at the barber's. And they had three or four barber chairs in there, and these guys in there with clippers just set on buzz. And they go, it took each guy about 3 minutes to give you a total haircut. And then everybody comes out with, because some of them are bleeding, you know, because the nicks are there. I remember this one guy had really thick black hair, and they kept stalling the clippers. They kept oiling his clippers and keep cramming at this guy's scalp, and geez. And then when you get out there, everybody's kind of rubbing their heads and kind of looking at each other, and it was one of the first things they did to make you just like everybody else.
Yeah. Yeah, you don't want to be anything different than anybody else, and you know, you're kind of dehumanized in that respect too. And just standing in line there, kind of, it was kind of worse than PE in in high school.
Only it's for keeps.
Susan, you can, you know, answer this if you want. But when your husband came back, did he talk about things a lot, or was he quiet, or was...
No, he didn't talk about things a lot. But a lot of the photographs that he sent me looked like he was on some kind of a tropical vacation. Uh-huh. And he did that on purpose. And when he came back, he had boxes of photographs, lots and lots of photographs that I had never seen of the war. Because the photographs he sent me were always him laying on the beach or, with shorts and sandals on with his buddies, because he didn't want me to be worried.
Yeah.
Didn't help. I still worried.
Yeah, I think it, and I did know several persons who had, you know, close relatives that were killed in Vietnam, and I don't think they ever... Well, you shouldn't get over something like that, but you know, you always hear people say, "Well, we had closure," or you know, at least we knew, you know, how the person was killed and under what circumstances, and that may offer something, but it offers very little as far as
nothing.
As far as I'm concerned. Mm. And the sadness, I think, too, that people occurred that occurred to people. This was a friend of mine who I actually saw several weeks ago. He said when he was in the hospital in Japan for malaria, and when he was in the hospital for malaria, he was in Japan, and he was pretty, you know, there were lots of different levels of malaria, but he really got it bad to where he was so dehydrated that he was in Japan in a hospital for almost 6 months. And he said when he recovered from the malaria, or when he started to get better, He said they gave him a job of delivering mail to the patients. He said, there I got to see the real cost of the war when I went to the burn centers and the amputee wards. And really seeing of the effect on people. I just think that overall, we need to think about all of the people that were affected and all the families. And if you've ever been to the have you seen the wall in Vietnam, Rick?
No, I haven't. It's an awesome monument, and again, completely unique.
Yes,
it's not a gung ho.
Washington D.C.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Have you seen it, Susan?
I have.
Yeah.
It's like the Iwo Jima monument is like, you know, gung ho, we did it.
Yes.
And the wall in Vietnam is like, here we are sinking down.
Right.
You know, and
it was, you know, I remember when the monument gave their interpretation to what they thought it should look like. It was very, and you can imagine all the emotion of families that went into that and how to do it. And Maya Lin, who was Asian, was the artist who designed the wall. And there was issues because she was Asian. You know, that came up. And then how it should look. And I've seen it numerous times when I've been back to D.C. In fact, when I go back, I try and visit it. Two things, and if you've seen it too, Susan, maybe you can comment after this. Two things that really struck me was the solemnness of people that are there. And you don't know if they had someone who was killed in Vietnam or if they were in Vietnam themselves and, you know, their friends were killed. But if just to kind of explain, it starts out on the left side of, and it goes by years of the number of people killed in Vietnam. And so it starts out very small on the first side. In 64, I think it starts out. And it gets bigger, and then it kind of goes back down the other way because to the end of the war. But I think, in my opinion, they could not have done a better job. It's somber. Go ahead, Susan.
The first time we went, our children were very young, and our son had a friend who was an old man in our community who was helping him with the stamp collection. And I knew him well. I didn't know anything about his son who had been killed in Vietnam. But when our son told him that we were going to go and we were going to see the memorial, he called me and asked me. He said he can't go. He just can't. But he wanted me to take a photograph and a rubbing of his son's name. And so we did. It was hard to find, but we found him. And we did the rubbing and took a photograph and gave it to him. The dad has since passed away quite a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that struck me is at that point, it had been probably 20-some years since he had lost his son. And the emotion was so, you know, right there, right now, when he talked to me about it, you know.
And when you, they used to always also have in the Museum of American History, they had an exhibit on things that were left at the memorial. And every night, they things are left at the memorial, everything from flowers to letters to just amazing things. Pack of cigarettes, fifth of Jim Beam. I mean, and again, we talk about those minor things, but to think about, or a lighter, you know, that has a peace symbol on it, those kinds of things. And you think about how, what minutia that is by itself, but how significant it was to some person at that time, and something that they've remembered all those years. And we just, we go on. If you've been back to the, and I've seen this in New York, the memorial to the 9/11, it's done very much in the same manner, with just names on it, and it's very, you know, stark, dark, black
stone
marble, you know, but really, really interesting. Rick, any other thoughts?
Well, I guess it's too late to say. I hope it never happens again.
Yeah. With Ukraine and
Ukraine for the Ukrainians, and Afghanistan and Iraq for the Americans. But I don't know if this is even fair to say, but at least we don't have a draft now. When you were taking people against their will and putting them into this situation, you know, I'm not sure anybody goes into the Army or the Marine Corps or anything knowing what they're getting into, really knowing what they're getting into. But to be drafted and put in that situation was, you know, I don't know, it's unspeakable.
Yeah.
To do that. I mean, you know, when they drafted Elvis Presley and sent him to Germany to, you know, be
right
in the Army over there, that was one thing. But to take people and send them to Vietnam, that's a whole other thing. And,
I've also heard, and this came from one of the people that I interviewed, was they almost thought that, you know, having a military now that's totally voluntary, that you have people that have kind of one mindset. They want to go there. They want to fight for their country. And this was a woman veteran that I talked to, and she said, maybe you're better almost to have the conscripted people, because you have a much wider range of people from all over the United States with a much, much more varied opinions about how they feel about the war. But
that's a heck of a way to solicit people's opinions on things.
That's right. And like, one of the things is, you know, we've had wars on the United States. We've had, you know, the war with the British, we've had the Civil War, and those kinds of things. But I also think we need to, as human beings and part of the entire earth, we also have to look at the people. There were 3 million, they estimate about 3 million Vietnamese servicemen and citizens, you know, innocent citizens that weren't in the military, that were killed because of bombings and those kinds of things. And one of the other veterans that I talked to said that a lot of times when they would go in after a battle, they would kind of get souvenirs, or they might find a big thing was to get a Vietnamese flag or a knife or something off, you know, that they got off somebody. And he said, he was, this was a dead Vietnamese soldier, and he saw that his wallet, or what would be equivalent to a wallet, was laying beside him. And so he picked it up and he looked through it, and he said what struck him was that there was a picture of the Vietnamese soldier, of his wife and two kids, he and his wife and two kids. And he said it brought to mind to him that their soldiers are fighting against us, but essentially, they're no different than us.
Right. All human beings.
You know, they have families, they have kids, and they grieve just as much for their loved ones. And we did talk, too, about, in this whole series about Vietnam, about how we really demonize, we really do demonize our enemy, you know. And you can't think of a war where that didn't occur. You know, in World War II, Hitler blamed everything on Jewish people. And it was easy to point a finger at them and for whatever reason and say, you know, this is why we're fighting and these people are bad. I mean, when we fought the Japanese in World War II, again, the same thing. You know, I mentioned that I saw a Christmas card that was sent from a veteran of the war in the Pacific, and it was a picture of Santa Claus with a machine gun killing Japanese people, and you know, just really, really sad things. Well, I think I'm going to kind of close up now for this series. And I have to say, it has really impacted me at my old age of, I have to remember, I'm 75 now, but we need to think, I guess my thought would be, we need to think what we're doing before we send people in harm's way to fight for, I think that we just need to think about it. We need to really be prepared before we get into conflicts like this. One last comment from you, Susan. One-liner here. And, you know, something, yeah.
I just can't come up with anything, but... Okay. Thanks for this opportunity. It's been interesting for me.
You really have been a blessing to us, and you bring some beauty to this studio that Rick and I have left far behind. So I guess I should speak for myself. But thank you very much, Vashon, for listening to us, and take care, and we will be back sometime.
Been listening to Is Abled with Dr. Stephen Nurse. This has been part 3 of his series on the war in Vietnam entitled A Letter is a Living Voice. To hear additional episodes, including his previous series on the Vietnam War, go to voiceofvashon.org and look for Is Abled under the Shows tab.